This morning's scripture comes from 2 Kings chapter 5, verses 1 through 3. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He also was a mighty man of valor, but a leper. And the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. Then she said to her mistress, "If only my master were with his prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy."
Morning. Just want to say a quick word of thanks, personal thanks, to those of you who are able to help us move this weekend. We moved to a different location in Glenpool. We're still here. We didn't leave the state or anything. And we didn't advertise, but a few of you showed up anyway, so we appreciate it. And even found some of my stuff this morning. It was nice. I found my razor, which was good. Some of you think I haven't found a razor in 2 or 3 years, but I did find my razor this morning. I think I know which box my ties are in, but I'm thinking maybe I'll just not look for them until it gets cool again, and maybe I'll put my coats in that box too. It is hot out there. Every time somebody came in from hauling boxes this weekend, it looked like they had run through a sprinkler. Everyone just completely drenched in sweat, and it was warm. We're going to be in 2 Kings chapter 5 today, 2 Kings chapter 5. As I promised last week, we're taking an excursion into the Old Testament, just briefly, a detour from the book of Luke and New Testament topics. We'll be in Colossians starting next week, but I've tried really hard to restrain my impulse to preach 52 Old Testament sermons a year, and so this is just one. So just being nice here, we'll do one sermon out of the Old Testament and get back to the New. 2 Kings chapter 5 is a fascinating story about a man named Naaman, the leper. Leprosy is such a foreign topic to us today, because we don't suffer from it. I think there's something like 200 cases in the United States annually at most. It's a mostly eradicated problem in countries with sanitation and hygiene and things like that. In third world countries where you have poverty, there's still leprosy. We still have leprosy in parts of India for population concerns and things like that. But by and large, it's not something we encounter very much. Not only that, we have treatments for it. So if you are one of those unlucky 200 people a year who get leprosy, there's a multi-drug cocktail that they give you, and it can help take care of it. It's bacterial. It's something that can be dealt with. We're not very familiar with it. But for the Bible, you may know, it's comes up quite a lot, actually. Jesus heals some lepers. Leprosy comes up in the Old Testament. There's an entire chapter of the book of Leviticus just dedicated to leprosy and leprosy-related diseases. It's Leviticus chapter 13, if you want to go home and read it. Fascinating. If you're looking for a gross chapter in the Bible, Leviticus 13 is the one. It talks about the color of the blister and which ones are disease and which ones are clean and which ones are bad. There's a whole, where's Bobby Hill? There's a whole paragraph on bald men and leprosy and which ones are clean and which ones not, depending on where they lose their hair, right? It's a fascinating chapter. It was a serious concern of the ancient world that was considered to be contagious, though leprosy is not as contagious as people think. It was considered to be very contagious, and it was a death sentence of sorts in that time and place. And it was terrifying because in a world without a lot of sanitation, it could get anyone. And to make ourselves feel safer, we would banish the people as far away as possible who had leprosy. But still, people, even people in power, sometimes came down with one of these strange leprous diseases and didn't know what to do about it. Leprosy, in some of its forms, is one of the strangest of diseases because it deals with the deadening of pain. You ever think about this? This is a philosophical side note, but just go with me a moment. You ever wish you couldn't feel pain? There are moments where you think that would be a good thing. Have you ever thought that pain is a really good thing? When you put your hand on a hot stove, pain says move. Okay? A person with certain types of leprosy might not have feeling of pain, sensation in their hand, and they start to smell bacon before they feel pain. And that's why leprosy is associated with losing limbs and body parts, not because like gangrene or something it rots them away, but because they do themselves harm and don't even notice it. A little cut becomes infected before they realize they have it. They don't feel the pain. So leprosy, for us, becomes a awful, ugly depiction of sin. Sin is something in our lives that seems strangely contagious. It strikes everyone in every position in life. It numbs us to things that we should notice and causes us harm that we don't know how to cure. Naaman the leper then becomes, even though leprosy is strange to us, a very personable story that we can relate to, because all of us have dealt with a disease we didn't know how to get rid of, whose main symptom was telling us it wasn't there. Sin is a grand form of leprosy. In 2 Kings chapter 5, then, we get some introductions to the man. And what I want to do in this sermon, you have probably at some point in your life encountered the story of Naaman the leper, especially if you grew up in the Churches of Christ, because it's one of our favorites. There's water in it, so we get to talk about baptism, so that's fun, right? So we like Naaman the leper, so you may have heard this story before. But what I want to emphasize is the person of Naaman himself and how he is depicted in the story each step along the way, and whether or not that matters. So look at how he's depicted at the start, verses 1 through 3, as we just had read to us. Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and in high favor, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little girl from the land of Israel, and she worked in the service of Naaman's wife. And she said to her mistress, "Would that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria. He would cure him of his leprosy." So first of all, take a look at Naaman. Naaman is a commander of an army. He's some sort of general. Okay, he is a respected man. He is a man of power. He is a man in high favor with the king. Okay, so the king is in charge, but this man has the king's ear. This man gets what he wants, right? This is a man of position and status. He is revered and regarded. He is a man of valor, so he's not just sitting behind a desk calling shots. This is a warrior. This is the man every Syrian wants their child to grow up to be, right? He's a warrior. He's a man of valor. He commands armies. He's powerful and strong. He's influential. The text of the ESV simply calls him a great man. By any measure of human worth, this man is important. This man is significant. And this man is great. And none of it matters. Verse 1 tells you why it doesn't matter. Did you catch that at the end? We've talked about this before. What does the word "but" mean in a sentence? If you're a parent, you understand. "But" means everything that was just said doesn't matter, right? I know what I'm supposed to do, but here's what I did. Okay. "But" means everything doesn't matter. He's a great man. He's a powerful man. He's an important man. But he's a leper. And none of the rest matters. Does being a powerful warrior enable him to fight leprosy? No. Does being influential with his king enable him to fight leprosy? Can the king wave a wand and decree, "I shall end and banish leprosy from my realm"? It can't be done. All of his influence, all of his status, everything that he has falls before this strange little disease that he can't do a thing about. He had become a social outcast in his own home. And to show you how strong this reversal is, this is a story of reversals. You'll see several of them. The great man starts out on top, it ends on bottom, because who ends up giving him advice? The king has nothing to offer, right? He has high favor with the king. Do you suppose every court magician and physician and witch doctor and everybody they could find had tried something to cure? Listen, he's the general who leads your army and he's in high favor. He's a powerful man. Every medical opportunity in that culture was at his disposal. And what this story indicates to me is that it had all been tried. Who is it that has power in this story in the beginning? It's not the king. It's not Naaman, the great man of valor. It's a little servant girl. Not just a little servant girl. She's not just a servant because she thought being a maid would be fun. She is a slave. She had been captured. So think about this on a scale of who's powerful and important in the story. Naaman leads the army. The little girl is from a conquered people. They are one of the people that the Syrians had conquered. And she is the spoil of war in the service as a slave to Naaman's wife. On a ladder of great and powerful and low and unpowerful, she is at the very, very bottom rung and he is at the very, very top. And none of it matters because he's a leper. She has something to say that's helpful and he has nothing. So what is greatness? Look at our culture and ask yourself, who are the great people? Boy, we could get some trouble there, couldn't we? Who are great people? Do great people run for president? Do great people run for office? Do great people play sports or star in movies? Are great people on television? Are great people wealthy and run successful businesses? Who are great people in our culture? I don't know who they are, but it doesn't matter if they're lepers. And remember, our leprosy is sin. It doesn't matter how powerful you are, if you are suffering under the disease of sin, a disease you contracted on your own, by the way. If you are suffering under that disease, no measure of human magnification and greatness can possibly cure that. You can ignore it. You can go live in a leper colony if you want with all the other sinners and pretend you're not. But at the end of the day, that's a disease you don't have the power to fix. So what is greatness? Maybe it's not what we thought it was. And the story continues because Naaman's not just a great man. He's a rich man. Look at verses 4 through 9. So Naaman went in and told his lord, "Thus and so spoke the girl from the land of Israel." By the way, I love that sentence. "Thus and so spoke the girl from the land of Israel." How impressed is Naaman with the little slave girl? Well, she said something. It was interesting. I guess we'll go try it. "What's her name, Naaman?" "She's the girl from Israel." "Yeah, but what's her name?" "You know, that girl." Really impressive. Naaman's the name we get in the story. Powerful people get names. Slaves don't. "Well, there's a girl from Israel. She said something. We want to try it." But he's desperate. Verse 5, "The king of Syria said, 'Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel.' So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, 'When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you Naaman, my servant, that you may cure him of his leprosy.' And when the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, 'Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Only consider and see how he is seeking a quarrel with me.' But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent to the king, saying, 'Why have you torn your clothes? Let him come now to me, that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel.' So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house." A lot of things to talk about there, but I'm interested in how Naaman himself is depicted in the story. And what do we learn about him? First of all, he doesn't just travel to Israel. He travels with a letter from the king. Okay? How important is that? That's an enormous significance. He doesn't just have influence with the king. He goes with his personal seal, his personal word, his personal order. A demand from the king of Syria to the apparently frightened king of God's people. And when this letter reaches him, what does the letter say? "You will heal him of his leprosy." Don't you like it when your boss gives you an impossible job? "You will finish this week. It will be done." Here's the letter from the king to the other king. "You will cure my servant of leprosy." Now, he has to know it's not that simple. Why? If you could just write a letter and do it, he would have done it. But of course, he can't. And so the king of Israel thinks this is some kind of trap. Someone is trying to pick a fight. He's given me an impossible task. I just want this small favor, cure leprosy. And then he's going to declare war on me when I can't. And the king is pulling his hair out. But more interesting than the kings involved, because notice they don't even get names in the story. They're kind of side characters. King of Syria, king. They're interesting, but they're not what the story's about. The story's about Naaman. How does Naaman travel? Naaman travels in style. He doesn't just hop on his horse and ride down there. This is a man who brings with him wealth. How come? Because wealth gets you what you want. And the human understanding of things, oh, you can sing all you want that money can't buy you love, but boy, it sure buys a lot of other stuff, right? Money can make you comfortable, and money can make you safe. Money can put you in a nice place to live, and even in our modern, very kind of equal right type culture, money can get you better health options. It can get you a better doctor. I mean, money still has its perk, even in our world where a lot of that is available. We have more health and better quality health available to poor people than at any time in human history. But it's still nice to have money, right? It still affords you some options that maybe another person doesn't have. That's incredible. And so he comes with money. What's the cost for the cure of leprosy? He doesn't know, but he's got it. What does it cost to impress someone enough to help you? I don't know, but I've got it. So he's got his caravan. These aren't things you need, right? He doesn't bring food because he's going on a long journey. What things are listed? He brings silver. He brings gold. What is the function of silver and gold? Okay, think a moment. You're going camping. You're going on a long trip. What's the purpose of silver and gold? Nothing. It's just a heavy thing you carry around unless you're trying to impress someone. Now, if you're trying to impress someone or buy something, that's what silver and gold is for. So this silver and gold, it has no function. It's not there because, well, you know, they're traveling and you need that sort of thing. He is bringing it just for the purpose of impressing people when he gets there, of showing that I am a person you need to help and I can pay. And so he comes with his camels and his 10 changes of clothes, right? Why throw in that deep? These are not normal clothes. These are wealthy clothes he can change a couple times a day and let people know, I am a man of means. This is about impressing people. Okay. He's a wealthy man. He intimidates the king of Israel. Now, he's not a king himself, but the king is terrified when he gets there. This is a man who can cause me problems. And then when he goes down the next trip, right, he goes all the way down to the king of Israel, then he goes down to the house of the prophet. And how does it describe it then? It leaves out the gold part, but listen to what it says about that in verse 9. So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. What do horses and chariots represent in the Bible? If you're an Old Testament reader, you might be familiar with this part of the story. In the earliest portions of the Old Testament, Israel was forbidden from using horses and chariots in battle. The enemies did. Egypt did. Pharaoh had horses and chariots. But God's people were forbidden. And one of the reasons is because horses and chariots are power. An army with a heavy cavalry, they win. And God wanted them to know that when you win, it's because I let you. And so God's people in several passages in the Old Testament were forbidden from making use of cavalry in their army. Now, when you get to the time of the kings, they start to break that rule. Solomon marries some folks from Egypt. He gets involved in Egyptian politics, and he starts to think it would be nice to have chariots. Solomon has chariots. And from that time forward, it starts to change. But up until then, you read the judges, read the stories of the judges. The enemy has chariots of iron, horses, and they count them and name them off and number them. But the people of God never do. Horses and chariots represent in the Old Testament the power of human might. Israel was supposed to win without it. How does Naaman show up at the door of the prophet? Is he a humble pilgrim seeking to speak to a foreign prophet? No. He is there as a general. He is a man of wealth. The shekels of gold are back over there. He is a man of means. Look at this big caravan. He is a man of power. He is there with military might. He deserves your attention. This is a great man, and none of it matters because he's a leper. Not one thing in his caravan could purchase his salvation. Not one thing in his caravan could purchase a cure. All of his armies couldn't defeat the disease that was killing him each and every day. And so what we see in these stories is a depiction of Naaman with everything a human could possibly muster and completely impotent before the threat to his own life. Do you see how this looks so much like sin when we think about it? You can have everything this world has to offer. All of the power and natural ability and gifts and all of the business acumen and all the cleverness and intellect, all the education, all the everything, whatever the modern equivalent of horses and chariots are. You figure out what it is. I don't know, maybe it's a really big computer. Figure out what it is. Whatever the equivalent of horses and chariots are, you can have it and it will do you no good in the face of sin. Because human power doesn't cure sin. It's our leprosy. It doesn't work that way. And the story works so well in that direction. But we're not done yet. We get to see Naaman one more time. He's not just a powerful man. He's not just a rich man. He's an angry man. Look in verse 10. That's a typo. It's supposed to be verses 10 through 12. And Elisha sent out a messenger to him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman was angry and went away saying, "Behold, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. So what happens here? Once again, 3 times in this story, this is number 2, a very unimportant person has something very important to say to Naaman. First was a little servant girl. Now it's Elisha's messenger. Elisha himself never even leaves the house. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. Let me pause just a moment. A couple of weeks ago when we were in Luke and we heard the story of the centurion, the centurion sends to Jesus and says, "Come heal my servant." Only he doesn't say, "Come heal my servant." He says, "Heal my servant." It's the Jewish leaders who say, "Come." And when Jesus is on the way to the centurion's house, the centurion says, "No, no, no, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof." This is the reverse of that. Naaman says, "You'd better come. I came all the way down here and you can't walk out your own door to see me?" He's enraged. He's angry. And why? Because he is an important person. He is a great person. He is a powerful person. He is a rich person. He is a person of means. He says, "Behold, I thought." That's usually the first place people get into trouble, by the way. "Behold, I thought." He knew how this was going to go down. He had pictured in his head, "I'm an important person. This is a person who can help me. I have done everything to show how important I am. Now, do something." And what is he going to do? First, surely he would come out to me. I know prophets are kind of fickle. Maybe they don't help everybody. They're going to help me. Do we have that attitude? I know other people get in trouble with sin, but I'm me. God may love everybody, but he likes me the best. And we have that attitude that thinks that we are worthy of some kind of special treatment of what's going to go. We're not like the other lepers. Not a whole lot separated Naaman from the other lepers. It didn't matter. He was a leper. And then what else does he think? He says, "I thought he would come out," and I love this line too, "I thought he would wave his hand over the spot." He's looking for a song and dance. He's looking for smoke and mirrors and lightning and thunder and the whole bit. He's looking for the full-on prophet experience. I mean, if this had been a pagan prophet, it would have been impressive. There would have been some dead cattle. There would have been some chickens. There would have been fire and blood and all kinds of stuff. This would have been exciting. Elisha has none of those things. Elisha doesn't come out of the house. "I thought he would wave his hand over the spot. I thought he would call on the name of his God." Watch the pronouns in this sentence, by the way. They're interesting. "I thought he would come out to me and call on his God." Not my God. I have no use for the God of Israel. "But I thought he would call on the name of his God and make something happen." So this is a very pagan view of gods in the ancient world. He says, "Oh, there's lots of gods. And what these prophets do is they work their magic incantation and they get the gods to do them favors. None of my gods wanted to help. And so I've brought all of my power down here and I wanted this man to wave his hand and do whatever he does and get his God to help me because I'm important." But that's not all. "Even the water isn't good enough." This is a national problem, right? Syria, it's an important nation at this particular moment in history, and he's an important man in an important nation. And he says, "There's better places for water. Much better place." He knows them by name. If this was just a matter of taking a bath, we could have done that back home. This is not dignified. This is not what any important, powerful man does. This is dirty old Jewish water. This is Jordan. And I just have no use for it. And so he's angry. Oh, he's angry and he's indignant. Do we get angry and indignant when God doesn't do things our way? We most certainly do. And it doesn't matter at all. He gets angry. He stomps and shouts, I suppose. He turns around and leaves. Did you notice that at the end of verse 12? So he turned and went away in a rage. He leaves. He's done with it. Does it fix anything? Does it help anything? No. He's still a leper. It doesn't matter at all because he's a leper. Take a look at your life. Does it frustrate you? Does it make you angry? You look at the things that you've done wrong and the sins in your life and the consequences of those sins, and you get angry and you shout at God and you shout at other people and all the things we do to show that we're important and I ought to get my way, and it doesn't matter because you're still a leper. My dad tells a story that I've always remembered when he was in grade school, like a million years ago. When he was in grade school, the teacher was lecturing them about good English and why you didn't curse. Why you didn't use cuss words. And about that time, a construction worker of some sort was working on something and walked by the window of the school and let fly 7 or 8 of them. And she turns to the children and says, "Now see, does anyone here know what that man's problem was? Does anyone know how to help him? Does anyone know how to improve his situation? If he was bleeding, would you know it? These are not useful words, children. We don't use these." Angry, well, boy, we get angry. We get frustrated and our face turns red and maybe we let some words fly or maybe we don't. But we get angry and we take it out on other people. We take it out on God if we can. Does it accomplish anything? James says it this way, "The wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God." God's goodness makes good in this world. Our anger doesn't do much. It just doesn't. He's angry, he's mad, he's indignant, he turns away, and it doesn't matter because he's still a leper. And no amount of outrage can change that. It doesn't matter that he's mighty, it doesn't matter that he's wealthy, it doesn't matter that he's angry and thinks he deserves something better. He's a leper, and that's all that matters in this story. And that's all that matters to you. You need to look at your life and look for the thing that matters. Sin is killing you. And I know that because it's killing me, because it kills everybody. It's what sin does. And it doesn't matter what else we have to stack against it. If we haven't talked about sin, it doesn't matter because we're still lepers. We've got to turn to someone who can do something about it. Because if Naaman shows us anything, our options are exhausted. And so the story ends with one more servant. I told you there were three people who are totally unimportant, who have something important to say in this story. The first was a little slave girl who said, "There's a prophet who can help you." The second was a messenger who came out and said, "Yes, there is someone here who can help you, and here's what he says to do. It's not going to make you very happy." The third is another servant of the man himself. Read verses 13 and 14. "But his servants came near and said to him, 'My father, it is a great word the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? He has actually said to you, wash and be clean.'" Think about that a moment. "It is a great word the prophet has spoke to you. Will you not do it?" If the prophet had said some amazing thing, something that appealed to his might or his wealth or his power or his opinion of himself, he'd have been all over that. The servant says, "Didn't he ask something pretty simple? Didn't he actually say this would work? Prophets of Syria couldn't do that. We came all this way because we thought this man could help. He says I can help. He offers a solution and you're not going to do it? Maybe you have more than leprosy." And that's the problem we all have. He was a stubborn man who wanted to do something great for himself. He's a stubborn man, and his caravan of wealth and power accomplishes nothing. Naaman in this story is an utter and absolute failure in every human measure of an endeavor. Everything Naaman believes he can try to do fails. And everything that he thinks about himself falls apart. And none of it matters because he's not a leper anymore. Look at verse 14. So he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. None of it mattered, because today he's clean. Can you think for a moment how dumb he must have felt on about dip number 6? Once, now I'm wet and dirty. 2, hope no one's watching. 3, 4, 5, 6, I'm still a leper. How absurd he must have felt. Knowing that when he comes up on time number 7 and it didn't work, he is now officially an idiot. Because he went down to some foreign country, listened to some voodoo man he's never heard of, went off to a foreign dirty river and dipped himself in it 7 times because he's a desperate leper. Do you realize how dumb he's got to feel on dip number 6? How absurd he must feel. And none of it mattered. Because on number 7, he came out and he wasn't a leper anymore. There are things about Christianity that are absolutely ridiculous. And I'm a preacher and I'm saying that. I love Christianity. I hope you understand. I'm not criticizing it. It's the same thing Paul says. Paul says the cross is a scandal. The cross is foolishness. The preaching of the cross is foolishness, he says to the Corinthians. He says, absolutely absurd. By any human measure, a crucified man can't help you. But we're not talking about human measure, are we? Communion, when we take bread and this fruit of the vine, this wine that we take, it's an absurd thing. But it's not. By any human measure, doesn't even fill you up. But by the measure of God's grace, it is communion with God himself and with your brothers and sisters in Christ. This water behind me, I think I've told this story before, but I'm going to tell it again. When we were building this auditorium, it came time to have the baptistry delivered. And the guy with the truck, this is all he does for a living. He delivers baptistry, which must be a very interesting job. He gets to meet a lot of church folk. And he delivers this baptistry. He says, now y'all are Church of Christ, right? Yeah, that's us. That's us right there. Church of Christ, right? He says, you guys keep water in the baptistry, don't you? And it really surprised me at the time because I thought, what else do you put in baptistries? But then I figured out what he was saying. He says, you keep water in the baptistry all the time. He says, you know nobody else does that? He says, I deliver these all the time. People leave them empty most of the year, and then once in a while they fill them up and use them. You guys leave water in there all the time. And he thought that was really strange. And you know, he's totally right. It's kind of a nuisance. Somebody has to clean it. Somebody has to take care of it. There's no good human reason to have a pool behind me right now. Why do we keep water in it year-round? Why do we bother? Because we're not talking about human measure. We're talking about dip number 7. We're talking about obedience to God. We're talking about being ready to do whatever he wants. If the prophet points that way, that's the way we go. We're talking about the fact that it doesn't matter, that every human measure has failed because we don't trust in human measure. Nothing else mattered that day. Everything else he was didn't matter when he was a leper. And everything that he thought about it didn't matter when he wasn't. If sin is destroying your life, and it is, recognize it for what it is, and realize that until it's gone, nothing else matters. Christ has come to make it possible for you to be clean of a disease completely beyond the scope of human medicine. That destroys not just the body, but the soul in hell. And he died to make that possible. And he said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. And Paul says it's absolutely ridiculous. And you absolutely should do it. That's the story of Naaman the leper. It's the story that nothing you think matters, matters. What God says matters. And he can make us clean. If you've not responded to God and his invitation, we offer that invitation now as we stand and sing a word.